Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at Menards.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Frank, from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
I'm well. I've missed you.
Yeah, I know, buddy. I've missed you too. It's been a whole week since we've talked, although I did see you last week.
You did. So that was too much for you, eh?
Yeah, I was out of
that. Yeah. Exhausted from my our interaction.
I know. I got to see your new Haas. It's very shiny.
Yeah, well, beside being covered in dust, it's pretty shiny.
Yes, I was amazed how much dust was on it, given it's only been in there for a couple of weeks.
But yeah, we make a lot of dust.
I guess that's
you know what they say. If you're not making dust, you're not making money.
I guess so. I try to contain my dust as much as possible.
Isn't that the machinist thing? You know, if you're not making chips, you're not making money. That's the mantra, I thought.
I guess so. I'm a very poor businessman, so who knows?
If you're not eating chips,
then you're not spending money. So what have you been up to this week, mate? What have you been working on?
Well, we've had some ups and downs, some highs and lows. It's been a bit of a crazy week. Lots happened. I feel like I've got a lot to talk to you about.
Well, that's good. Okay, let's hear the lows first.
We had to let someone go.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Was this someone that had been with you for a while?
Not too long.
No. Yeah, I mean, hire slow, fire fast, right? Like
that should have been the case. It was probably too slow. It was just a fit thing. Nothing beyond that. But it's hard. Like, that's the first time we've ever had to do that, and I feel bad.
Yeah.
You know?
That's fair.
So that was a bummer.
But it always is, but it's better to pull the Band-Aid off than to, like,
let everyone dealing suffer.
You know, like, if you said it's a fit thing, you know, if they're just not meshing with the team, then, you know, that can really ruin the dynamic if you let it go on.
Yeah, and just making sure somebody's actually, like, the good fit for the actual role, too.
I mean, yeah.
So, and on a more positive note, we're going to start the hiring process again, which is always kind of exciting.
So if someone listening wants to work with you guys, they should get in touch.
Keep an eye out for, go follow us at Frank_Brothers on Instagram. We'll probably post, let everyone know there, but also we're just going to, you know, post it through the regular channels.
Kijiji, Craigslist.
Yeah. Good stuff like that. Facebook Marketplace. Yeah. I mean, I bet you that would work.
Probably, yeah. So what were the other ups? What were the other ups this week?
We got vacuum.
Ooh.
In our with our fixture plate.
Nice.
So
Nick needs to explain a little bit there. You're doing vacuum fixturing on your Haas.
Yes.
And now you've got vacuum fixturing where my cat is yelling. I don't know if you can
Hear that actually this time.
He's very loud. But you've got it working now.
We do. Yeah. So
that's exciting.
Black phenolic from Garolite from McMaster Car,
which looked
very badass looking.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's the fixture plate is basically it's like four vacuum chambers essentially. So it gives us, it'll allow us to fixture different shaped fixture plates. And then 5/8 inch bushings or dowel pins that stick up out of that, and then the fixtures have the female bushing.
Right.
So that the fixture plate will vacuum down to the table. Okay. Oh, which is the fixture plate? I always confuse myself with this.
Right. One's a subplate.
Yes.
So I'd say the subplate is the one that stays on your machine, and the fixture plate is the one that you're taking on and off.
Right. So the subplate has four different vacuum zones.
Right.
The fixture plate has the 3/8 inch, or the 5/8 inch female bushings. That'll suck down. The, you know, it'll, then on top of that fixture plate will be whatever we're machining.
Right.
So those fixture plates themselves, some of them are also going to be vacuum.
Mm, right. So you have to do a pass through.
Yes.
Or it's, I guess it's.
It's not actually pass through. Yeah. It's, it's,
you have
its
like
own
a separate
line.
Connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Cause you don't want to lose vacuum on the top by accidentally cutting through a workpiece or something and then lose vacuum on your fixture plate and have the whole thing get sucked into the spindle.
Yeah. Like a 10 pound piece of mahogany.
It's right.
Lifts up and flies across the room through the sheet metal through the next room. I don't know if mahogany would have that kind of velocity.
Yeah. So you're referring there to the video that I sent you of that face mill, right?
I watched it.
So if you guys, I put it in the show notes for, I think it was the last show where basically a really big fly cutter. It's what, it's got to be like a foot long or something.
Yeah. It was bigger than I was actually even expecting.
Yeah, in a Haas machine, I think it's a programming error or they spin it up too high and it fails and it leaves the machine. It goes through the sheet metal enclosure. It goes through a concrete wall. It goes through a metal wall. It goes through a steel chair and then it embeds itself in a wall.
Yeah, it was awesome. That.
It was, yeah, it's like one of those things because no one was hurt. You can like appreciate the fury of this thing, you know?
Yeah, it was wild. It made you appreciate, respect the tool.
Yeah, don't put a one-foot fly cutter in your...
Yeah, that seems like an insane thing to do.
I think they're facing cylinder block heads. It's kind of a common thing.
Oh, okay. Like, yeah. Well, yeah, we're not planning on doing anything so, right. Wild. But the first thing we're trying to get done is transfer the body... machining like the parts that we machine for the body on from the axes onto the Haas. So what we have now is the subplate, a fixture plate that fits on top of that, and we can mount a mahogany body or any whatever we use. Mahogany, we use carina, which is just another type of wood,
right.
Ash. You can now put that down on the Haas. We still haven't cut wood. But we're close. We're closing in on that goal.
Awesome.
And it looks great.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, that black phenolic that you used for the table looked really good. I might actually have to look at some of that and see for handle scales.
Yeah, totally. It actually, like, so Mark, he came up with that idea of using the black phenolic. And he used, what was it? You were there when he said it. It was linseed oil. Double boiled linseed oil and finished it, and it looked awesome. So I don't know, how do you finish your handle scales?
You just wipe them down with mineral oil,
okay,
and then I dry them off with a microfiber cloth. So I mean, really all you're trying to do is like get the dust out of the pores,
right?
Because the material itself doesn't actually change color. It's just when it's dusty from machining, it looks lighter, looks crappy. I mean, the G10, which is the material I normally use for my knife handles, holds its color really well.
It does. So I mean, it looks great. It's vibrant. This stuff is paper, like the paper garolite or phenolic. So I don't know how that would, like, does that change your opinion of how it act as a knife scale?
It's been used for knife handles for a long time, actually. It's just like paper micarta is what they call it. It looks great. Like I haven't really used much of it previously. But I'm expanding the types of handle scales that I'm offering at the moment. So,
yeah. Are you going to tell people that you're trying to pilfer wood from us for handle scales? I just told everyone.
Not yet. Yeah. You just told everyone. Thanks. Well, I've actually got our mutual friend, Jeremy, gave me a giant block of Wenge.
Oh, cool.
Like that thing weighs like almost as much as a piece of aluminum wood. You know, it's the same size. Like it's really dense. So I'd really like to make some handle scales out of that. I think I've got enough to probably make like probably 50 handle scales.
Yeah. Wow.
So
I know, it's so nice to have small your object is for that reason.
Yeah, not much materials cost if you're talking about wood. I think G10 would be more expensive than wood.
I've got scrap that you can you can just have.
Have to come and have a look, have a poke around.
So that's where we're at. Like,
nice.
It's awesome. Like, Mark has just like dialed this thing in. He's getting really comfortable with the Haas. I want to start putting my time in with it. It's funny. Like when we did the Axies, we got that up and running. This is still collaborative, but it was a lot more collaborative. I'm just so much busier now with other things. What I'm really keen to do is watch your Fusion video.
Yeah, I think you'll get a lot of value out of that for sure to get started in Fusion. I'm doing the next one right now. So the first one was like making a Lego brick. You know, it was very, very introductory. Mm-hmm. The second one that I'm working on at the moment is making a knife, start to finish, like blade, handle, scales, all that in Fusion. That should be fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, I haven't watched it, but
well, you should get on that.
I know. you should send me the rough edit so I can I feel special.
Yeah, for sure, man. Sounds good. I've been working on fixturing too, eh? I've been doing the fixturing for my kitchen knives, and that honestly was a total shit show. It made me feel like a real noob. Like it's fine now, but sorry, like I was doing all the toolpaths for. So basically, my fixtures are made up in two sections. There's kind of an integral subplate, which is a 1-inch thick chunk of aluminum, 16 inches by 22 inches. And I actually had that water jet cut.
Right.
So I had little like kind of slots cut on either side so that I can just bolt it straight down to the table without losing any travel. And without having to like do a bunch of, you know, machining prep on it. So I bolted it down to the table upside down, machined the locating pins, and then did a bunch of through holes to screw down or to bolt down steel plates on the top of it. And then all of the actual fixtures are those steel plates on the top.
Gotcha. So does that first aluminum plate, that subplate, do you remove it, put the screws in? Like every time?
No. So basically the steel and aluminum sections all stay together permanently. The only time I would replace the steel top parts is if I was like making a change to the fixture.
Oh, because your whole fixture, you have one fixture on it and you just...
Yes, and it comes off the table. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if I need to do a different process, the whole fixture comes off the table.
Gotcha.
And the problem is that when I bolt down all those steel components onto the top, and then I go to machine all of the locating features in, like bolt holes and all that kind of stuff. And in Fusion, I had the stock set to taller than it should have been.
Oh no!
So the zero point of the fixture was actually like below the table on the CNC. So I ended up cutting everything about 50 thousandths lower than it should have been.
Okay.
And I didn't realize that I was doing that. So I broke a tool. I broke a 1/2-inch roughing end mill in the middle of the fixture because it was taking a bigger cut than, it should have been. I also screwed up the tool path for that. Like it's been, so like, I don't make new tool paths for new parts all that often.
Right. You
know, mostly I'm making changes to, a pretty well dialed in process. So rather than doing like the high speed machining style where you kind of spiral outward, in this case I just kind of like zigzagged in and then took a full width cut, and yeah, I really shouldn't have done that. It like bogged down the spindle on my machine and I couldn't get there fast enough, so it's, you know, it's like, and I couldn't get there fast enough to hit feed hold, and it like the chip load just kept going up and up until it broke the end mill off.
Well, at least the machine's robust enough to handle that.
It's no problem.
Tool that breaks.
Yeah, like a 1/2-inch solid carbide end mill snapped off.
Yeah.
No damage done.
I feel like our axes would just like
explode.
Yeah.
Just self-destruct.
The head would just tilt over.
Yeah, right. So yeah, that kind of sucked. And then I was like, oh God, like, do I so I ordered some spare material. Do I like pull all these steel plates off and like make new ones? Because they're all machined on the bottom with locating pins and all that kind of stuff, right? Like,
so you put a significant amount of work already into these.
Not like a ton, but you know, a couple of hours. And in the end, I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just gonna redesign the fixtures, like change the parameters in Fusion so that everything's 50,000ths lower, and just keep on going as if nothing happened.
It seems reasonable because you're just changing, like,
yeah, it was.
It's an offset essentially.
Yeah, it worked out. It was fine. Ultimately, though, the actual entire design of the fixtures should have been a bit taller. So I removed quite a bit of material from the steel, and the reason that I focused on making them somewhat low was to keep the weight down, because with the steel and aluminum parts all together, the whole fixture before any of the machining weighed about 130 pounds.
Wow.
So it's kind of hard to move it around.
Like, it's hard to move it around physically or for the machine?
No, it's hard to like pick it up off the table and like, you know, put it away for storage and stuff. You know, it's doable. It's just, I don't think I want to do that, you know, a couple of times a week.
You're not beefy enough.
Exactly. Not beefy enough. So yeah, you know, I made all of the steel parts thinner to cut a bunch of the weight out, and the final weight was around 70 pounds. But by lowering them, you know, so as you know, like most CNC machines can't actually put their spindle on the table. Mm-hmm. There's always a gap, right? And by making them that little bit shorter, I actually ended up with the situation where my tool holders are too short.
Oh no.
They couldn't reach the, yeah. So this is like, I'd planned for everything except for this, I guess. So it actually hasn't ended up being a problem. I ended up having to pull my tools out of my end mill holders by about an eighth of an inch.
Okay.
Which isn't that much, but it's more. Do you use
a lot of stubby tools?
Yeah. Really stubby tools, really stubby tool holders. Mm-hmm. Like most of my tool holders are less than 2 inch gauge length.
Right.
And like many of them are like down at like 1.5 inches gauge length. And then my tools are really stubby too, with only like 3/8 of an inch of flute length. So it just ended up being that I just had to like expose a bit more of the cutting tool than I would like. But it's fine. It's fine.
Have you noticed anything as a result of that?
No, not as yet. I mean, so like these tools are really, these are the ones that Maritool make custom for me. So they're a 1/4 inch diameter end mill with 8 flutes, which, you know, means that they have a really big core. Yeah. And then the flutes themselves are only 3/8 of an inch long.
Wow. Okay.
So
and any how long amount is of tool, the overall length of the tool?
About, I think it's 1.5, 2 inches. You know, so I can expose an extra 1/8 of an inch or whatever. And all I'm hanging out is like solid carbide.
Yeah,
you know,
cool.
It's not like a floppy, you know, 2 flute end mill or something. So yeah, no issues at all so far. And I'm actually getting really aggressive with the machining. So I'm doing with the kitchen knife machining, I'm doing everything hard milled. I'm starting with like a straight rectangle of A2, and then everything is hard milled out of that. And I'm doing the roughing passes at 120 inches per minute. With a 2.5 thousandths depth of cut and then full width of cut on the tool. So I'm doing like high feed style milling.
Full width of cut. So if you're using a 1/4 inch diameter tool.
So it has corner radiuses.
Okay.
It has 60 thou corner radius. So when I say full width of cut, it's like the full flat bottom of the tool. So it's actually like 0.1875. So 3/16 of an inch.
That's pretty significant though.
Yeah. And so the interesting thing, basically, I had a tooling engineer a long time ago tell me that if you have a corner radius end mill that has fairly large radius and you take shallow step downs, then you're basically treating that tool like a high feed mill. So the cutting forces, rather than like going sideways into the end mill, because the part of the end mill that you're cutting with is very close to being flat, like the corner radius is, you know, very shallow at that depth of cut, all of the force is going straight up into the spindle. So you can get away with being really aggressive. Like I'm taking 3.5 thousandths of an inch per flute on that tool.
Okay. In hard steel.
In fully like 60, what that was 64 Rockwell A2 tool steel.
That sounds pretty hard to me.
It's very hard. Yeah. Like that's harder than most drill bits.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, like I can still run that aggressively and, you know, I seem to be getting decent tool life.
And what are you going for? Like finish? Are you going for speed?
In that case, I mean, so like one of the things that machinists say, particularly like mold makers, is they're like, you make your money when you're roughing because you have to remove so much material that like, if you can get it out of there quicker, then you can get to your finishing more quickly.
Interesting.
And you know, the surface finish doesn't matter when you're roughing. So like, you know,
so that's
get
what you're
in
doing
there as hard as you can.
This is your roughing operation.
Yeah. It's my roughing operation. And part of the issue was, so this machine, so I have two Fidals. I have Millie and Vicky, and Millie is the older one. She's a VMC 10. And previously I've never been able to run feed rates on that machine over 60 inches per minute. Like I can program it, it'll run it, but then sometimes when it hits a corner, it'll fault out. It'll say like servo overload. And I've been trying to work out what was the issue for years, and I never really had any luck. But there's this company that I've been talking to, Fidal Parts, and the owner of Fidal Parts is one of the family that originally made the Fidal milling machines.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so he's a super nice dude, Dave DeCarson. He's a really, really nice guy. I've had a couple of like hour long phone calls with him just cause he like was enjoying the conversation. So we just talk, you know? But yeah, so he gave me some pointers. I actually ended up retuning the servo drives on that machine. And now I'm running 120 inches a minute. No problem. So that's taken what would have been an 8 hour cycle to make the kitchen knives down to just over 4 hours.
Wow.
Which is a bit ridiculous. Yeah. So I'm still in the process of developing those tool paths. It's a bit of a tricky thing to machine hard steel all the way down to like the blade of that knife is only 10 thousandths of an inch thick. You know, so that's like two sheets of copier paper.
Right.
So yeah, it's a bit of a tricky thing to get it right. Like I've been having some issues with resonance kind of building up in the blade and like the whole thing starts like squealing.
Oh, and does that translate to a surface finish?
It does, issue? Yeah. And it will, it's not too bad for surface finish, but it will destroy the tools more quickly because it means the tool's like kind of vibrating in the cut. So honestly, like I've taken a very low tech approach to that old school trick, which is modeling clay. You just wedge modeling clay underneath. Cause basically I've already machined one side of the blade and then I'm flipping it machining the second side. So that like empty space underneath is what's causing the vibration.
Right.
So you just pack it full of modeling clay, clamp it down, and then you're good.
I feel like I've also heard of people using hot glue.
Yeah, so I actually didn't have any modeling clay at the shop, and so I used hot glue for some of the test runs.
And is one better than the other? Is the modeling clay better?
Modeling clay is more reusable, and I think it's a bit better for damping. Hmm. So I've got some on the way. I'll be using that for production.
Yeah, cool.
So yeah, it's going well so far. I'm going to be doing some interesting stuff with this one. Like I've actually got three separate models, like CAD models of this knife. Two of them are oversized, so the outline of the knife is actually larger than it will be in real life. And one of them is actually missing like a feature from the blade. So the blade itself has like a channel in the middle of it that helps air get in behind food, so it gets released.
Oh, cool.
But basically, those oversized models let me program all of the 3D toolpaths so that the tool changes direction when it's off the actual blade. So basically, that means that the parts of the toolpath that are always the sketchiest are when you're reversing directions. Like the surface finish will change there, or it'll, you know, because it's slowing down, it will dwell for a second, and so it'll bite into the material a bit. By moving all of those direction changes off the actual finished product, I can get a much better surface finish. And it's going to let me do something that I'm excited about, which is I'm actually going to be trying to use a ceramic fiber deburring brush to actually do automated finishing on the machine.
Whoa. So it's like kind of, that's a tool you put in the spindle.
Yeah. And it's basically going to be rubbing these ceramic fiber bristles over the surface of the steel and actually like finishing out the tool marks.
Interesting.
Still on the machine.
But you haven't tried this yet.
I've been trying it with a nylon bristle brush, but because the steel's so hard that the nylon brushes just can't really move enough material to do it.
But it does something?
It does, yeah. It definitely polishes it up. It's just not really taking out the tool marks.
Cool. That'd be amazing if it did.
Right? So, yeah, with the ceramic fiber brushes, I have been led to believe they should be better. And for the prices, they should be. I don't know what the price is yet. No one's told me, and that's always a bad sign.
If you have to ask,
yeah,
exactly. Too expensive.
So I'm expecting I'll probably get into it for like, you know, maybe a couple of $100, but that's going to save me a lot of hands-on time.
Anything you can do to reduce the downstream processing,
is huge. Exactly. So basically, I'm going to be breaking the machining process up into sections. Like basically, the first section is going to be a roughing pass, and it will remove most of the material. Then I'll do a semi-finish and a finish pass. But all of that is on that initial model, where it's actually missing all of the features. It doesn't have any through holes for the pins. It doesn't have that channel for the air. It's just a flat blade. And then after that's finished, I'll come in with the brush and do as much finishing as I can. And there's no corners to round over. There's no geometry to lose because it's just a flat cavity, right?
Okay.
And then after that is done, I'll come in and put in all the other features. So like the pin holes and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So then what's going to be left for you?
Oh, they'll still be hand finishing. Unfortunately, my machines aren't good enough to fully... Like, I'm pretty confident that if I was programming this on like a Haas VM series machine or even a VF... that I could get it to the point where it's like no hand finishing required. Well, I think Aaron, your machine, like the super speed machines are. Yeah, I know. Right? I know. I think the super speed machines are a little less good on surface finish than the.
Now you tell me.
Well, I tried to tell you. but that's, you know, that's fine. Like I'm still going to be having a very reasonable amount of hand finishing, I think.
So. Right. Well, that'll please all the handmade, no C and C people.
Yeah, you know, you got to put some hands-on time in it. Mm-hmm.
But that's really cool. That's fine. I mean, I love the idea of finishing has got to be, for us, the biggest bottleneck.
Yes, and it's like, totally the same on my side too. You know, like it's, 100% the biggest bottleneck. So anything I can do to help reduce that is great, especially for a kitchen knife because the area that you have to finish is so much larger.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, like, so I've been thinking about how to incorporate the CNC, like a CNC process into something I'm currently doing by hand right now, which is re-leveling the fretboard. And it's something I've become pretty good at and fast enough at, but it's like one of these things. It's like, it's kind of, it would be a hard thing to pass off to somebody.
Right.
It's and it would be something the CNC could do very easily if we were able to fixture it.
Okay. So when you say re-leveling the fretboard, you are... So if I remember correctly, you're machining the shape of the fretboard on the CNC.
Yeah.
From the back, right? So you're putting in dowel holes and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you flip it. You do the radius on the fretboard.
Yes.
You cut the slots. Then you glue it to the guitar.
Then we glue it to the neck.
You have to, you glue it to the neck. And then you have to re-level it, which you're doing, I guess, with like a sanding, radius sanding block?
Yes.
Okay. And then you're fretting it.
Yeah.
And doing
fret. And the reason it has to be re-leveled is because as soon as you glue that fretboard to the neck, things change.
Right.
It's wood. We build in a what's called relief into the neck. So mm-hmm. the neck itself has this sort of concave geometry.
Right. It's not straight. It's actually curved.
Yeah. The piece of wood is not dead flat. It's got a curve in it, a belly. And when you glue the fretboard on, depending on the piece of wood, the density of that wood, what, you know, like species it is, we use different couple different types of materials. It in like the fretboard stiffness, things just always end up in a different place. So then once it's glued on, I tension the truss rod a specific amount, and then I re-level it by hand. Sometimes there's still a bit, like there's still a big belly or concave.
Right.
I guess belly is not the right word. That's the opposite.
Because it's inward. Innie. Yeah.
It's an innie.
It's an innie.
Concave though. Right. So I, you know, sometimes we're talking about the difference between 20 and 30 thou of relief. Right. But if I could just tension the rod, fixture it on the CNC could come back and level the board again. But the complicated thing is that it would have to be perfectly square because to how the fret slots were cut, because those go across the fretboard. And then it's radiused as well. So
yeah, and you'd be fixturing it from the back side of the guitar, exactly. which doesn't have any locating features on it, really.
No. So it's like it's easy to do by hand. It would be way more complicated to do on the machine. But
how long does it take to do it by hand?
Well, this is the thing. It kind of depends. It depends how that piece of wood has reacted. Sometimes there's a lot more relief that needs to be dialed out, because we kind of put in an exaggerated amount of relief and expect to remove some.
Right.
Because basically when you untension the rod, you still want there to be some relief.
Yes.
Right. But you don't want to be too much relief, because then when it gets down to the assembly part, it's already been fretted. If Tim has to put anything more than a half a turn in, the neck could be potentially compromised. Any more than that, and you're really wrenching on the thing.
Right.
So it's something that I really want to be able to do on the Haas, but maybe isn't the right time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me, I always look at that stuff and I'm like, okay, so what's a half step? You know, could you use the Haas to make you know, better, more accurate radiusing sanding blocks? Could you have like a set of sanding blocks? I'm not sure if you've seen, you can actually get diamond abrasive foil. So you can get like foil sheets that have, or like they're like, it's like a piece of steel shim stock that has diamond abrasive electroplated to it, and then it's got a self-adhesive on the back. So you could make like you know, a radiused aluminum sanding block with like diamond, a permanent abrasive attached to it.
You know? Oh, you love diamonds.
Diamonds are great.
Always going on about diamonds.
Diamonds are great. So Nick's telling me that, because when I was at their shop, I was talking about diamond.
You guys heard about diamonds?
Diamonds, guys, diamonds. Well, for abrasive materials, where you need a really good finish, so for the G10 that I use on my handle scales, the diamond, so I'm using PCD diamond anvils that Frank at Maritool, again, I'm gonna keep singing this guy's praises, because he had them custom made for me, and they're amazing. They are super pricey. It's like $250 an anvil.
Oh,
but yeah, but I'm still using the first one.
Okay.
Like, as long as you don't crash them, they basically last forever, which is crazy, you know.
Well, that's, yeah, so the thing about abrasive, like, if we're talking about as a replacement for sandpaper, sandpaper loads up. That's typically what kills it.
Yeah, but it's a little bit different, I think, with the diamond abrasive, because the electroplating kind of covers up the gaps in between the abrasive grains. So there's not so much space for dust to get in. And then you can just vacuum it. You know, like, that's what I do. Whenever the abrasive starts loading up, you just hit it with a vacuum with a brush.
Worse for your health would be blow it out.
Yeah, there, sure. If you want to do that.
So another middle step would be this is a tool you could buy to do this, would be a belt sander. And then you have a jig that sits above the belt sander, and it's a swing, and it can swing the neck And
you can have a different
radial pattern.
Different arm length.
Yeah. Yes.
At either end.
If you wanted, yeah, to create like a compound radius.
Right.
But
I don't know if you can, sorry, I don't know if you can hear that noise in the background here.
Is it a kitten?
It's my cat snoring.
Wow, what a lazy cat.
He's living his best life, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess you could just do that, but then I don't know. I think that you would probably want to be hands-on with that. Like, that feels like a process that you'd want to take really carefully.
Similarly, like with hand, doing it by hand.
Yeah.
I like the idea of putting it on the machine. We can probe it. We can, you know, I like my probe.
You love your probing action.
Yeah,
I mean, man, I'll always encourage you to go for gold, but like, I think you would probably want to make more changes. Like, you know, are there places on the neck where you could put locating features?
Oh yeah. Well, this is what
fixturing easier.
Yeah. And Mark and I have been brainstorming this idea for a bit now, because it's another big bottleneck for us. And it's something that takes you know, the people we have here working with us are skilled, and I could train somebody to do this, but it's like a stupid task almost. I feel bad passing this off. It's kind of like, it's not fun to do, and it's very extremely nitpicky, like, even though we are already being nitpicky. So yeah, Mark and I have been talking about this a lot, and he's got some, you know, big ideas about how we can achieve it. I like to really go as simple as possible. So yeah, how do we fixture it? How do we work hold this, really, is the only problem we have. Yeah. And then how do we get a consistent result?
You know, with CNC machining, that's pretty much always the problem.
Yeah,
like,
I guess so.
Work holding is pretty much always the problem. Like, every other part of CNC machining, you know, holding tolerance is probably the only other part that's like really difficult. And that's only when you're holding really tight tolerances.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you were to be given like, you know, a part that's like plus or minus 5 thou, like, you don't have to measure end mills, you don't have to stock at that point. Like, get a pair of calipers, you're golden, you know. But like, really tight tolerances and difficult fixturing, I think, are the two parts of machining that are by far the hardest.
Right. Well, so this is, I would say, it kind of falls into both those categories, because, well, tell me if you think these tolerances are tight. But fixturing, it's hard because A, we've got an already machine surface on the back, and depending on what model and what custom neck shape we're doing, that surface is going to be different. So an arcade has a smaller, a shorter heel, and that's the thing you would fixture off of. If that person wants it with a chunky neck versus like our standard medium C-shaped neck, which is thinner, you know, you've got your reference surfaces are all over the place. And then the tolerance we're holding is 1 thou over like 19 inches. Less than 1 thou, really.
Right.
And then
it's also right now radius. You're checking that with a straight edge and feeler gauges?
Yes.
Or how you right. Yeah, I think honestly to me that sounds like not a good candidate for CNC.
Okay.
Not at least for the moment, because when you have like so many different variables, like, you know, you're saying like the neck shape is going to change, all of your fixturing locations are going to be moving around. Yeah. So you're either going to be making like a bunch of fixtures to automate this task that it isn't that bad. Let's be honest. It's not that bad. I kind of like, how long do you think it's taking you? Like, is it a half an hour fretboard?
It can. Yeah. It can take a half an hour. Sometimes if I'm feeling off, I need to spend a little extra time doing it, because there's no result.
Most days then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The measurement doesn't lie. Like, it has to be perfect. But have I told you about our probe?
Right. So you're saying the alternative could be just to slap it in whatever position and then
probe the shit out of it.
Probe away. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, that's not really a solution that I think of, because I don't have a probe. You know, my cat snoring is cracking me up over here. He's really
this
loud.
Is something I think in the show notes you have to put a video of your cat snoring. I've never seen a cat snore.
Oh dude, he's a lazy bastard. I guess if you've got the probing cycles worked out,
which we don't, but we haven't even touched that. I mean, Mark's the definitely like
he's the prober.
Well, he's probed a few things.
He's gonna be the prober.
Yeah, he's keen on it, and
yeah, that's fair.
I am too. I think there's a lot we can do with it. Well, for another example is. When we're making pick guards, this is kind of low hanging fruit for us. We just make a 2D. It's a 2D object with a chamfer, and three holes. We're gonna vacuum fixture that, which is gonna be a huge step up from what we're doing now, which is double stick taping it basically with green tape and super glue. We take a piece of plastic down flat, so on the hoss it'll be. Vacuum. So we put a piece of plastic down. It's flat. It's going to cut a shape, three holes, chamfer. But we have the material is a different thickness. Not every time, but batch to batch, the material we use is like changes in thickness. Right. We use different types of materials. So we're talking about like multiply ABS. So like three, like a black, white, black, like layer of ABS.
Yeah, it's like laminated.
Yeah, tortoise shell, acrylic.
So you would just come in with the probe, test, a couple of spots, average that to be your thickness.
Yeah.
And then
that'll dial in the chamfer. That's the important part. In the chamfer on the holes so that I can take it, or the countersink rather. So that I think will be a good place to dip our toes.
Test your probing chops.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I mean, for me, like, the reason I've designed the new process for the kitchen knife the way I have is, so with the Resolute, with my hunting knife, stock thickness, the variation in stock thickness has been a real problem.
Oh.
And I have to buy precision ground stock to avoid that. And even then, the precision ground stock isn't actually precision enough.
Oh, what's the tolerance?
It's supposed to be plus minus a thousandth, but I've seen 159 thousandths, 160 thousandths, which is 3-4 thousandths off what it should be.
Wow.
And
do you like it before you put it on and that will change how you approach it?
No, I don't anymore. It's just too much hassle to do that. So basically I changed the machining process so that it actually machines flat faces in some critical parts to make it so that the thickness doesn't matter as much.
Interesting. This is where you would want like a grinder.
Yeah. Surface grinder. But for the kitchen knife, what I'm actually doing is all of my stock is oversized and every surface is machined. So like the initial stock thickness just doesn't matter at all.
So you're leveling the whole piece of material first.
No, I'm not actually. I don't even care. What I'm doing is I'm cutting some location faces to a specific height that and those serve as the locators for the second operation. And then I'm machining down to a certain thickness for the shape of the blade. But then outside of that, I just don't care. I'm leaving the stock oversized.
Right.
Because all of that is scrap anyway. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a smart fix.
Yeah. And that's nice because it means that if I know that I'm going to get a batch of stock that's like 40 thou oversized, so all of my process right now, all of the toolpaths have an allowance for about 10 thou. Mm-hmm. But if I know that I'm getting stock thicker than that, I just change the thickness of the stock in Fusion and then all of the toolpaths will update.
Right.
Cause basically it's just saying the thickness of the stock plus a 10th hour allowance. So if I change the stock height, then all of the toolpaths regenerate, to know that they have to just cut some more, do some more passes.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's going to be really nice too, because it means I can be much more much less selective with the condition of the material.
Right.
So like I can buy like hot rolled or cold rolled material. It doesn't have to be precision ground.
So that's going to be cheaper.
Well, it's not so much that it's cheaper. It's that some materials are really difficult to get at all, let alone to get them in a precision ground condition. So it's going to make it a lot easier to source material.
Ronnie, were you buying metal from Starrett at one point?
I have bought metal from Starrett, yeah. All of my steel right now comes from a company in the States called Precision Marshall, who have overall been the best supplier of flat stock that I've had.
Oh, cool.
There's another company in the States that was importing flat stock from Germany in hot rolled sheets, blanchard grinding it, vacuum annealing it, then precision grinding it and laser cutting it.
Oh, wow.
They were great. Like, so the company's called Knife Maker Kinetic. You know, if anyone needs that kind of a process done, they are fantastic. The main issue for me was that their lead times were really long. Mm. Like the shortest lead time I ever had with them was like 9 or 10 weeks.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was long.
So yeah, it just makes planning really difficult. And the batch size was very large with them. Like I'd have to order, you know, 200 or 300 blanks at a time to make it reasonable in cost.
So who are they servicing?
They actually, their normal business is with like the paper industry. So they'll make like slitting blades and blanking blades. You know, so if you have like toilet paper, you need to like cut it into rolls, right? So they use like these razor sharp discs that are like 12 inches in diameter and really thin. And they actually like cut the rolls with that kind of stuff.
Cool.
Or when they're manufacturing like books, like to read or like textbooks, mm-hmm. they actually have these big blades that come in from the sides and trim the book to the final shape.
Oh, that's cool.
So they make all of those kinds of blades for like, you know, plastic industry, paper industry, that kind of thing.
Neat. Okay. So knives wasn't necessarily, that doesn't mean like boutique knives.
No, it means no. Like so they make knives. Machine knives. Right. Yeah. They make what they call machine knives. So it's, as I said, it's like slitting blades or whatever.
Right.
And yeah, so like I got connected with one of their like head guys on Practical Machinist. His name's Cash. He's a super nice dude. And they offered to start, importing and machining the steel for me. And yeah, they did a great job. It was just, the surface grinding to get it to a point where the surface grinding could be used as is in one of my knives, I would be paying a lot of money for surface grinding.
Right.
So like they were finishing all of the steel to a 32 RA finish for me. And I think it would have to come down to like an 8 finish for it to be like acceptable to go to a customer.
Okay. Lower is shinier? Yeah.
Lower is shinier. Okay. Yeah. So it's basically like how many micro inches up and down are the pits and valleys of that surface. Mm. You know, so 32 is like 32 micro inches up and down. 8 is like 8 micro inches.
A micro inch.
Yeah. It's a weird number. But yeah, basically I was like having to machine those surfaces anyway. So I basically what I did was change my processes to be more tolerant of a greater variation in thickness, and then that let me buy off the shelf precision ground stock instead.
Smart.
Which is much shorter lead time, less expensive, more available.
This is somewhat relevant, but I do remember you telling me a while ago, build in bigger tolerances where you can, because it makes manufacturing something easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this case, the bigger tolerance is in the input. Like the output still has a very tight tolerance. Right. It's just that I'm designing the process to be more accepting of looser tolerances.
It's interesting. Like, so manufacturing, it starts when you get the material, but just getting the material is a challenge in its own.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
100%. Well, like, so I'm trying to slowly move to a new steel called AEBL, which is, a very fine grained stainless steel. So it's actually tougher than my A2 tool steel, and it's by far the toughest stainless steel that you can get. The only problem is that, like, if I wanted to just get one piece of it to make one knife, not a problem. That's totally easy. If I wanted to buy 5,000 pounds of it, also not a problem. But if I want to get 300 pounds, it's a real issue.
Oh, so everything in between is the challenge.
Yeah, everything in between is the challenge.
You got to buy so like 5 pound or the lowest amount 100 times at that price point.
Yeah, you know, like if I wanted to get 5,000 pounds, I can get it cold rolled to custom specifications, like whatever thickness I want. The lead time will be like a year. Like literally I've been told the lead time is like a year, but I can get it. You know, it's no problem.
How long would that last you?
A long time, a very long time. But yeah, you know, the problem is like, I don't have the capital to buy $80,000 worth of stuff.
It's also just a bad idea. I mean, even
yeah,
because
like, what if I need a different thickness?
Yeah, or you're
future,
like, right? I don't like this steel.
Exactly. You know, so, you know, buying just a couple of sheets, you know, the sheets are like 72 pounds worth of steel each. Buying a couple of sheets would be ideal. But when you're buying a couple of sheets, you cannot specify your thickness unless you're, you know, sending them somewhere else to have them custom blanched ground or something, right, which is very expensive. You know, so I have to buy sheets. Like, I only need sheets that are 125 thousandths. I'm going to be having to buy sheets that are between 130 and 150, you know, it's like the tolerance is quite wide.
Okay.
And the finish of the sheets is, it's a hot rolled finish. So it's like straight out of the mill. It's been descaled, so it doesn't have any like black funk on it, but the surface is very rough and pitted, you know, so you need a certain amount of allowance to finish away all of that pitting on the surface. And yeah, if I wanted to like make my process really fussy and require a precise thickness and a precise, you know, finish, I would be waiting until the end of time, or I'd be paying out the ass, you know, it'd be really brutal.
Yeah. Wow. It's a tricky problem. I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah, every part of manufacturing is difficult, right?
Well, we were on the hunt for some genuine mahogany, and ooh, similarly, what we were looking
wait,
for.
Wait, hang on a second. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. Well, actually,
is your cat purring again?
No. What the hell is fake mahogany? Why is it genuine mahogany?
Good question. That's a great question, actually. Genuine mahogany is also known as Honduran mahogany.
Oh,
it's
okay.
The Latin is Sweetenia macrophylla. Sweetenia macrophylla. It's the species.
Right. But so what you get is like mahogany.
You get
quote,
the
unquote,
real McCoy, the real deal mahogany. It's a tropical hardwood. It's so the alternatives would be mahoganoids. So you've got like right. Kaya, which is an African mahogany, which isn't the same species.
Is that spelled
K-H-A-Y-A.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
You've got
so if you just go to a lumberyard in North America and you're like, I want some mahogany for my deck.
They might
or my
give you
bathroom.
I don't actually know the answer. They might Kaya or African mahogany is very commonly used. That's what Gibson's using, I think, a lot of the time now. Sipo is another one. Sapili, I don't know the Latin names
right.
for these ones.
Right. Because I know that Honduran mahogany is like a controlled good.
Yes.
Right?
It's,
you have to provide certificates for it to be able to ship it and all that kind of
yeah,
stuff, right?
Yeah. It's a very highly controlled. And Honduran doesn't mean it comes from Honduras either. Actually, I don't think you can get Honduran mahogany from Honduras anymore, which is why we call it genuine mahogany. We have some Honduran mahogany that was imported like a long time ago before those specific regulations. It's Sweetenia macrophylla. It's the species. So another version is Fijian or Fiji mahogany, and that is the same species. The British came to South America or Central America rather. They took seeds of the Honduran or of the mahogany tree, planted it in Fiji, grew all this Fijian mahogany for the boat building industry, and then boat building, right. Making boats out of mahogany became obsolete or out of wood. I should look into that more before. Don't quote me on that, because I mean mahogany, I don't know how common that is. Oak, I think, is like a more common wood, big right. Shipbuilding. But you definitely there right. Are mahogany boats. So
fancy ass boat.
Yeah, it is a fancy boat. You see them out in Muskoka all the time. If you're from Ontario, right. you might know.
So I guess sourcing this like lumber is like really a big deal.
It's a trick because it's to get it in what we want is 10 quarter. So 10 quarter is 2.5 inches thick. And right. That's an uncommon size. You typically get it in 8 quarter, just 2 inches thick, or 12 quarter. I don't know if you can hear this, but my
air no, we can hear you totally fine.
Is
The air compressor is very quiet, though.
Yeah, screw compressors.
Yeah, right. I love the measurements for wood. Hilarious.
I know it's
10,
so funny.
10 quarter inches makes 2.5 inches. Yeah, great.
10 quarters of an inch stacked on yeah. top of each other.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Right. So
it's an unusual thickness. Right. And the reason we wanted to do that, to use that thickness, is because 10 quarter can be used for the bodies of our guitars are unusually thick compared to like right. a Fender, which is like 1.75 inches thick. Gibsons are thicker, but I think they probably still get away with 8 quarter, 2 inch thick, because they have a big maple cap on top. We don't do that.
Right.
So our bodies are a little thicker. So by going up to 10 quarter, we, it makes it easier to make a body. You're not as limited by the thickness. Cause sometimes if you buy 2 inch thick mahogany, it comes in a little under, and that makes it tougher to process. To get the final thickness that you actually need out of it.
It's something funny with the lumber industry is like anytime you buy a size that you'll generally get less wood than that.
Yeah, you might.
2x4 isn't 2x4.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in the machining industry, if you ever get stock undersized, like that's a big deal.
Yeah, you're getting screwed.
No one gives you stock undersized.
You're still kind of getting, I guess, a little screwed in wood too, but I think it's generally accepted. Maybe yeah, that right. your final thickness is going to be significantly less than the original thickness. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that much
control, right?
Well, we can't lose that much. The body thickness of our bodies on the CNC had to be no thinner than 1.9 inches. So we only have 100 thou to work with if they come in exactly at 2. Sometimes they come in over. Like, I guess it depends on the mill you're getting it from. Like we'll get right. to 8 quarter that's 2.1 inches thick.
Right.
So anyways, we have 1,000 board feet of 10 quarter waiting for us. And what's nice about it is I just need to arrange a delivery. That's a lot of wood, but it can be used for all of our models, like the Arcade, the Signature, the Ultralight, which are varying right. thicknesses, and it could be used for neck stock as well,
right? Nice.
So it's much more versatile dimension, yeah.
right? But I guess you had to buy a lot of it to get
we did, because we have a partner company that we work with that imports hardwood lumber. They're like the premier hardwood people in Canada and in the US. They have right. Businesses in the US as well. So they're like on the hunt for this. It's kind of a unique thing, and we want really high quality stuff. So we've got pattern grade. We found pattern grade, which is the highest quality grade for genuine mahogany. Right. But we had to take the full 1,000 board feet.
So, and what the hell is a board foot? That's a measure of length and width, right?
And thickness.
And thickness.
Yeah. Oh, so to get a board foot, you take the length, multiply that by the width, multiply that by the thickness, divide it by 144. That's how I know how to do it. It's a similar equation to get to square footage. You just don't need the thickness.
So it's actually a measure of volume.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. woodworkers, crazy bastards. It's right. So 1,000 board feet. That's so you're probably getting it in like 2 foot wide boards or something?
No, they come in varying widths because it's, you know, raw material. Think about a tree is round. Right. So the center of it, if the board comes out of the center, it's going to be really wide. So you can get it up to, you know, I have pieces of wood that are 24, 25 inches wide.
Right.
But some of it's 4 inches, 6 inches. Mm.
That's not it. I guess that's like for you guys, that's only a neck then.
Yeah, it's less. That's not as versatile a width for us. Right. But we have to take what we can. You know, you're buying, when you buy a lift of lumber, you're getting a tree, just cut up in various, in like a bunch of different shapes. So picture cutting up a cucumber.
Right.
You know, like you get the thick part in the middle, and then it gets thinner towards the outside.
And but I guess you're getting it's all going to be quarter sawn lumber from individual trees, right?
Not
it's not quarter sawn.
No, some of it will be. Depends how they cut it.
And you don't get to specify any of this. That sounds frustrating.
Could I think if you were to say I only exclusively want quarter sawn, you're going to pay a premium for that,
right?
And we don't actually need just quarter sawn. We like flat sawn for bodies. We need quarter sawn for necks, but it doesn't have to be sawn as quarter sawn. When they're cutting up the tree, they could saw it in a certain way that would yield the most quarter sawn.
Mm-hmm. But then you're wasting more lumber, right?
Yeah, it's trickier to do, so you pay a premium for it. But we could buy flat lumber, so lumber that that if you looked at the end grain, the grain is going flat along it's parallel to the surface of it.
Right.
We tip that on its side, that you get a neck out of it. The neck, if you were to look at the neck, you'd be like, oh, this is quarter sawn, because the grain is running horizontal and parallel to the neck.
Right. Yeah, so for people that don't work much in wood, like, do you want to explain the difference really quickly between flat sawn and quarter sawn?
Sure.
That's basically it, right? It's the direction of the grain.
Yeah.
Versus like the outline of the lumber.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good way to explain that. I don't know if I know.
Well, I know for sure that quarter sawn is when all of the grain, like the rings in the wood, are perpendicular to the surface.
Yeah.
So they're at 90 degrees, they're going up and down.
Yeah.
And then flat sawn, so like quarter sawn lumbers, as far as I know, is, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the most desirable because it's very dimensionally stable and...
It's the most desirable for neck, guitar necks.
Right.
Not always the most desirable for other things.
Right. Because it's not going to have any like figure and so on.
Well, it can have, what you can get is quarter flower. You get this sort of like, so like in maple, you see it like looks pixelated. And some people don't like the way that looks. So a quarter sawn might not be as desirable in like a floor, for say. If you're making floorboards. Or something like that.
Interesting. So yeah, it sounds like you've got a lot of lumber on the way.
We do have a lot of lumber. So anyways, just thinking about like, there's so much that you need to think about in terms of buying materials, like your you know, metal and or like buying wood. These are all like raw materials. Like it's not so simple.
Yeah, particularly when you have like really high expectations for that material. Like I have very high structural expectations for my material, you know, and so when I was working with Knife Maker Kinetic, they deal with a steel mill in Germany called Liebenstahl. That's like a small family-owned steel mill. And they are responsible for pouring the steel and then cutting it into ingots and rolling it. So they have a mill and then they ship it to Knife Maker Kinetic and they do the grinding. And we got a batch of steel from them one time that unfortunately, when you're sawing the ingot, you're supposed to cut off the top because you end up with a lot of slag and inclusions in the top. So like bits of glass and all sorts of other stuff that are kind of byproducts of the steel making process. And unfortunately they either didn't cut deep enough or they accidentally used the top piece that they were supposed to be throwing away. And so I got a bunch of steel that had inclusions in it.
Oh, weird.
And when I heat treated it, I do vacuum heat treat, or I did at that point do vacuum heat treat, and the inclusions expanded. And so I ended up with this steel that was like full of blisters.
Whoa. Had you ever seen that before?
No, I've never seen it before or since.
Or heard of it?
Nope.
Wow. Yeah, you just picture metal being just so like a monostructure. Homogenous.
Yeah, yeah, but it's totally not. And fortunately, Liebenstahl and Lohmannstahl and KnifeMaker Kinetic were both fantastic. Like, I actually sent samples back to them for lab analysis. They confirmed that it was inclusions from the mill, and then they gave me a replacement batch of material.
Did it take, what was the lead time on that?
It did take a while, yeah. Yes.
Well, good for them for sorting.
But yeah, they totally made it right, you know. And there was some usable material in there, so I got, you know, some usable and then a bunch free. But yeah, as you said, you know, like sourcing material, particularly when you have high expectations, is really, really difficult.
Well, and, you know, these like people like dedicate their whole profession to certain materials, you know, like there's people out there who know everything about steel, everything about wood.
Or about sourcing those.
Yeah,
things.
How to find
they're
it.
Like supply chain specialists.
Yeah. You know? So, I mean, the mahogany thing, like mahogany, like the person we are working with to source it, who works with Upper Canada Forest Products, who's our like partner company, he's got decades, I think, of experience and in all these connections. And it's like, you can't just like Google buy genuine mahogany. You'll get all the people that sell it, but you don't get the people that source it. And they're somewhat private about who they're actually contacting.
Because I imagine there would be a lot of money if you have
the right connections. Yeah.
Well, and if you could sell fake genuine mahogany, mahogany, then there's probably a lot of money to be made because people will be willing to pay a premium for the real stuff.
I bet. I mean, this is why it's such a regulated industry, though, and is like they can be. They don't have to disclose who they're getting it from, but what they do have to disclose is the chain of custody. So you know exactly where it's come from, what hands it's passed through ultimately.
Yeah. My understanding is they have to do that to try and help prevent deforestation.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, exactly. I mean,
no, it's going into old growth forests and cutting shit down.
Yeah. It's an extremely renewable resource, but it's also a fragile resource.
Yeah.
They have to be, and that's so a lot of the lumber we're getting is from community forests, where the people that live there are the ones that practice the selective forestry, replanting.
Right.
It's generations of families, so it's interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super cool. Well, geez, we're all over the place today.
Should we just pick up tomorrow?
Yeah, I think we should probably wrap up. I think that's a show. We've got some questions for the next show.
Oh, it's a bummer when we don't get to the questions.
Oh, it's fine. That's fine. Scott Hoadley gave us some questions because he felt sorry for us not having enough questions. Oh, so I think he's okay to wait for a little bit. I find that stuff super interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, like as you said, like it's crazy how much work. Like I've literally spent 2 years trying to source the steel that I want to move to next. You know, and I'm sure that you had a lot of time in sourcing that mahogany as well.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know, with mahogany, it's like you might not ever find that specific stuff again.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's natural. It grows, you know, that it's not being manufactured.
Right. And it's very different to, you know, when you can just buy like 6061 aluminum off the shelf.
Right.
50 suppliers will have it. Mm-hmm. Or like 1018 cold rolled steel, like no problem. You know, it's big.
It is cool though.
Big process.
How the like parallels between the two very different products we manufacture. How many parallels are.
Right. I think too, it comes down to the level of quality that we desire. I think that's probably the thing that draws the biggest parallels. Because like, if I was just happy to just use whatever
you could find,
Chinese tool steel or whatever, then it'd be pretty easy. But like, you know, I have had different suppliers over time, but from month to month, I only ever buy from the same supplier. I have one supplier that I trust. You know, I know whenever I send a sales order to them, it's, you know, steel will only be supplied from this mill.
Interesting.
You know, because yeah.
Oh, so you're specifying the mill it comes from.
Well, I'm specifying Precision Marshall only. So I buy through a distributor in Canada that stocks Precision Marshall.
Okay.
And I specify only Precision Marshall. Cool. And then they have their own quality control. I've talked to
them. So they might be buying it from different mills, but they are...
Actually, I know what their mill is. Okay. The reason I deal with... So I deal with a place called The Steel Store in Canada. And they are the regional distributor for Bowler Uddeholm, which is a European... steel manufacturer, and Precision Marshall only buys their tool steel from Uddeholm.
Oh, cool.
So basically I source through them to get steel from Europe, from Uddeholm. So yeah, as you said, it's like this weird chain of custody, you know, the steel mills in Europe that are controlled by Uddeholm.
Right.
And then they're shipping raw, like hot rolled steel to Precision Marshall, who are doing the final processing of it. And then I'm buying from an Uddeholm subsidiary in Canada that buys from Precision Marshall. But yeah, you know, I do that to avoid getting sub quality steel from like China or something thrown into the process then, you know, supplied without me being aware of it.
Yeah, that's kind of wild.
Right?
Maybe you should just start making your own steel. Really go.
Have you and I talked about that? Is that why you're bringing that up? Because I have actually thought about it.
Of course.
Yeah. It may actually be something I do down the line. Basically, I have looked into doing my own melts of steel and then doing inert gas atomization, where you make like steel powder and then you consolidate that into bars by heating it and then pressure welding it. So you're basically like putting it in a big press and squishing it till it becomes a solid. But the really cool thing about that process is I could make bars to the exact size that I need, and all of my materials would end up being recycled. So like all the steel chips and everything that I make from machining could just go right back into the next melt.
How realistic is that?
Surprisingly more realistic than you would think, actually.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Like I don't think I'm going to do it in my current location because I just don't have enough space. But like
that might keep the guy next door up. You like forging your own metal shirtless, banging on it with a sledgehammer.
It's not going to be any of that.
Indulge me.
It's not going to be Conan the Barbarian. But yeah, I mean, like I can literally buy like 52-100 like barium quality carbon steel from McMaster for like a completely reasonable price, and that would be one of my main feedstocks. So like rather than using like a shitty unknown quality like low carbon steel or recycled steel, I would actually buy like bearing quality steel and then melt that and add the extra ingredients that I need.
Oh, crazy.
So the extra chromium and so on,
that would be
my final product. So I'd be like skipping a bunch of the steps because I don't have to source like raw iron, you know, but like we'll see, man. We'll see. Down the road. I don't think it's a next 5 years.
It's funny, though, where your head goes. Like, I mean we keep thinking about, like, if only we could do our own nickel plating. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, metal parts that we want nickel plated. Like,
why don't you get into it in forestry, man? Like,
I mean, I could.
Genuine mahogany is going to be
my backyard.
Easy. Yeah, right?
I don't think Canada's the climate.
No, right. Go to Fiji. Go buy some land in Fiji.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like,
all right, man, we could, you know, we could shoot the shit all night. So we should probably call it. We should say goodbye to everyone.
Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, to our crazy ramblings. Mm-hmm. If anyone's still listening, that is.
Scott's listening.
Scott's listening. Yeah, we know. I hope everyone has a good week, and we will talk to you next week.
All right. See ya.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.